I'm happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ray Raphael. He is a senior research fellow with Humboldt State University in Northern California. He is the author of 16 books, the latest of which is Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, it's pleased to be with you in Santa Fe, even though I'm actually in California.
Right. Now, why did you write this book?
Well, I've been living in the late 18th century for about 20 years, and so I have some familiarity with just the way people thought and what they were doing, what their concerns were. And that's sort of about half my time. And the other half of my time, I live in the early 21st century. And I'm watching people wave their constitutions in the air and saying, see, it's all right here. These guys thought exactly the same way that I do. And all you have to do is read the Constitution and you'll see. And so I'm looking at the Constitution and I don't see what other people are seeing. I see a historical document where people are talking about things that concern them at those times and how to address those issues. And I'm watching people totally tweak history, just reading it backwards to suit their own political agendas. And as a historian, this bothered me. So I thought, you know, I want to just set the historical record straight. What were they doing back then? What were their issues? And if we can see what they were doing, and then we can have a better, if we can see that honestly, we have a better chance of seeing how that might be relevant to us.
So you have a number of myths that you, each chapter is about one of the myths that people have about the Constitution, and you talk about the grain of truth that's in each myth, but then also the kind of bigger picture around that. And the first one is, and this is things that we hear in the kind of media today, that the framers wanted a weak federal government. To what extent is there a grain of truth in that?
Well, the grain of truth is that during the revolutionary period, people were very suspicious of large government and kind of the intrusiveness of the government emanating from the crown and parliament into their lives, and they didn't want to repeat that. So there was this kind of basic suspicion. That's the grain of truth. But now you have to fast forward from 1776, the point of independence, and after the war, and the first constitution they created was the Articles of Confederation, and this one was so weak it really wasn't a government; it was just a confederation. Congress, which was the only body empowered by the Articles of Confederation, could not levy taxes. It had to ask from the states, or really beg from the states, because there were no enforcement powers. And it couldn't even pass any laws. It just really couldn't do anything. It was more like just sort of a convention. And they said, we need a real government, because this thing is starting to fall apart, and European governments or European nations are surrounding us, and they're just waiting for us to implode. And there were all kinds of economic concerns then, and there was kind of class warfare developing, and they said, we need to create a government. We need to create what they called a vigorous and energetic government so it can embody the will of the people.
Now, as you point out in the book, which I think is really important, is there's a really big difference between how people were thinking in 1776 and how they were thinking in 1787.
Yes, yeah. A little piece in the Philadelphia Gazette at that time during what we now call the Constitutional Convention. They called it the Federal Convention. And it says, you know, 1776 was a revolution in favor of liberty, and 1787 is a revolution in favor of government. And that's what it was, because when they got together on the second day of debates, actually, they overthrew the Articles of Confederation. They dumped the existing Constitution at that time, saying, there's no way we can mend this. It's just too weak. We have to start from scratch. And that's what the Constitutional Convention was all about, starting from scratch to create a viable, workable government, to give it enough powers to secure property, liberty, and allow people to govern themselves.
And securing property and liberty, to a large part, meant police, armies, things like that.
Well, they figured, you know, that's a component of any nation, is you have to have some enforcement procedure. And that was the immediate trigger to it, is in 1786, there was a lot of unrest breaking out all across the in several states, really just about all the states, it came to a head in Massachusetts, what people call Shays' Rebellion. Actually, that's a name that was applied to it. It was, they called themselves the Regulators, but they were kind of marching on the state government, and they were trying to take it over because the state had passed these oppressive tax laws, and they were trying to get some kind of debtor relief because there was really extreme debt problems there, and there was not sufficient powers to put that down. When the Massachusetts appealed, first they called up the militia, but half the militiamen joined the rebels. And then they appealed to Congress, and Congress says, what are we going to do? We don't have any power to do anything. We just got a handful of soldiers out on the western borders, and that's it. So what happened is it was put down by a private army. So you have people rebelling and a private army going against them. And this is no recipe for stable government, stable community, a stable state, a stable nation. They said we have to do something to have a power that can just keep things under control. And in particular, they were concerned with all these debtors who were really in Massachusetts and elsewhere who were trying to take over the state legislatures.
Explain to us what the concept militia meant at that time.
Militias were the embodiment, the kind of the armed embodiment of the people. Like in New England, they had town meetings, and then they had militias. So, you know, instead of having standing armies, when needed, you would call the people up. And this was a very key issue for them. And actually, if you want to understand the Second Amendment, you really have to understand what they were talking about.
Right.
From the standpoint of the people of those times, I mean, standing armies really raised a lot of suspicions. They had so much grievance with it against Britain, and even when there was resistance to it, even when the Continental Army came in, and there was kind of a real rift between Continental soldiers who were professionals and the civilians. So they wanted to have an alternative to a standing army, so the standing army couldn't just oppress the people, and that alternative was the militias. And the Second Amendment is all about, let's make sure that the militias are always in place. That's what a regulated, well-disciplined militia is all about. The militias need to remain in place so that they won't get so weak that all we have is a standing army. It had nothing, since we're kind of under the Second Amendment here, private gun ownership was not an issue. Of course, everybody had guns. You know, they have hoes and shovels and horses and stuff. I mean, that's just part of what they did. Note that these are not semi-automatic weapons automatics, or, you know, I mean, there are things that take, you know, 30 seconds to a minute to load the second charge. So, of course, they have them. And then, of course, they have safety regulations, because another myth that we have is that the government was all about liberty. The government was about the common good. And for the common good, you have to cede certain liberties, such as the liberty to store as much powder as you want in your house, because that's a fire hazard. So all the local governments in those days, they all had strict fire regulations about how much powder you could store in your house. That was their kind of issue, just like we have issues today about gun regulations. That was their safety issue. And the idea that somehow individual ownership of just is somehow, you know, precludes safety, or vice versa, the strange debate we have to now is just foreign to them.
Is there any equivalent to that militia in today's society? I mean, I don't know, volunteer firemen or?
Really, it's kind of strange, because really, you know, historically, it's kind of, you know, I guess the National Guard is kind of the last vestige of that. Because when you think of the idea of having a body of citizens that can stand up to the standing army, that doesn't really have a lot of application today. I mean, who's going to stand up to the United States Army? I mean, nobody in the world can. I mean, how can the people of whatever, you know, Podunk, Nebraska, or whatever? I mean, you know, you just it doesn't really make a lot of sense now because times have changed so much. So we really don't have that kind of armed sense. And the militia movement, is actually somewhat correct, and the militias were very important. What I'm talking about is the right-wing militias who wanted to basically do stand up to the federal government. And what they get wrong is militias were public bodies, absolutely public. They were empowered by their town governments and by their state governments and by the Constitution, actually, by the federal government. They were public bodies. There is no such thing as a private militia. The whole point is it's the embodiment of the people, all the people.
So in that sense, some of the worries of the framers of the Constitution have in fact been realized, which was we have a insanely powerful standing army and navy and air force and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, they were worried about concentrations of power. And that's when you look at checks and balances, okay, that's about concentrations of power. Now, let me just address a little side myth here. Actually, it's a very important myth, and that's why I want to address it. People think that because they had checks and balances, that meant they wanted a weak government. And it's exactly the reverse. They wanted a strong government because the government needed to have the power to levy taxes and pass laws for the common good and do all these, and, you know, they said common defense and general welfare. They needed a government to do that. But if you're going to grant government a lot of powers, how can you make sure that some small group doesn't take over that government to exert those powers? And that's where checks and balances come in, is to create these foci, these separate foci of powers that can check each other, right? So they wanted to have checks and balances. They did want to check power, to check foci of power. And they would be, people on the right are correct that they would not really foresee such a sweeping federal government as a foci of power. Nor, however, would they see such immense power in concentrated corporate wealth. I mean, they were totally anti-corporate in this way. If you look at the times, I mean, the whole Tea Party thing was about the giant power of the East India Company. And that was another, they wouldn't, you know, this thing about corporations or people and all that stuff, I mean, that is so foreign to their world. Corporations were supposed to be very strictly checked. Nobody could issue a charter without a year. You know, it's not like they live forever. They had very finite times and purposes that they had to live by. So the irony is that they wanted to check powers, and yet here we are in a nation on earth which has evolved the strongest military, the strongest government, and the giant corporations, great centralization of power. And so we live in very different times.
And as you put in the section of the book, which is about the myth of original intent, if you were really going to interpret the Constitution based on original intent, you would have never had the decision that we do have of corporations as people and citizens united.
Of course. And that's the great irony about these originalist judges. My gosh, they cry, originalism, originalism. We always have to go back to the original intent. And then here comes this case before them. The Citizens United, and they say corporations are people. Now, anybody out there in Radio Land at Santa Fe, try to show me where corporations are people in any of the thinking of the founders, any of the understanding at the times. I mean, it just wasn't there. Money is speech. That is not there. That's not that. This is our world that we're talking about now. It's not their world. And as a matter of fact, they would be petrified at those thoughts. Particularly, they believed in Republican government, and that meant that you needed to get a government removed from the influence of the private sphere so that you wouldn't have people for their private benefits taking over the reins of government. In other words, absolute checks on, I mean, they would have loved all these checks on the private influence over the public sphere. They would have wanted more and more and more than we possibly do. And any reading, any possible reading of the founders that's serious sees all that. So there is only one originalist view of Citizens United, which is to strike down all that. I mean, don't strike down the limits on corporate spending. You know, keep them, exaggerate them. I mean, keep them going. And yet, for some reason, these guys just don't raise a peep about originalism there. They only use it when they think it serves their purpose.
We're talking to Ray Raphael about his book, Constitutional Myths. It's interesting also when we talk about the myth of originalism. I mean, you have Clarence Thomas trying to do originalist interpretations of the Constitution. Wouldn't he have just been three-fifths of a person if we were really going to be honest about it?
No, we can't be that honest about it because he wouldn't be three-fifths of a person, because we do have to see that the Civil War amendments, the Reconstruction amendments, 13th, 14th, and 15th, would have elevated his status to a full person and given him the right to vote. But Clarence Thomas, he has the strictest form of originalism, which is originalist intent, and that just falls. It's not even able to enter the hearth of a standard for interpreting the Constitution. Because if you believe in originalist intent, you will say, what was the intent of the founders when they did? Their intent must have been to have their intent be the way to interpret the Constitution. But James Madison, who's one of the founders, and people look to his views a lot, he's very, very clear. He says the original intent has absolutely no play in interpreting the Constitution. What the people at the convention are thinking has nothing to do with how we interpret the Constitution. We just cannot see it that way. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that if it were in his favor, he would quote, but it basically just destroys his whole argument. It negates his whole argument just by applying his argument to itself.
Well, also, and as you point out very eloquently in the book, there was not one kind of artist who came up with the Constitution. It was people who were continually battling with each other over all kinds of points, and the Constitution is a compromise.
Yeah, exactly. So what is the original intent of the three-fifths compromise? What is the original intent of all sorts of issues like that? The original intent, really, I mean, if you're looking at it that way, the original intent, to be honest, was to secure enough votes to proceed on to the next level so that they could get something passed. I mean, it's not like, oh, well, now let's parse the words three-fifths. What does that really mean? You know? No, it doesn't work that way. It was just a compromise. They were just trying to get this thing going, get the ship of state launched, and then they could deal with it. Parsing the words of originalist intent is just not what they had in mind at all. And the compromises themselves were just so strange. Like three-fifths, most people know that means that slaves would count as three-fifths of a person in terms of representation. Well, where'd they come up with that number, three-fifths? Well, what they did is 4 years earlier, they had a dispute where the North, and the issue then was how much should we charge each state? How much should we assess each state to pay to the federal coffers? And the North says, well, you've got to count all the slaves because they work, so count them so the South will pay more money. And the South then says, no, don't count any slaves. I mean, they're not, whatever argument they had. They didn't want to count the slaves, the North did. 4 years later, you're talking about representation. Suddenly the South says, oh, yeah, the slaves, they're real people. They could do everything. And the North says, oh, don't count those slaves. They're not, you know. They totally reversed their position. And the only thing they kept constant was the fraction three-fifths. And that's where the three-fifths compromise comes from. So what's the original intent of all that? You don't get anywhere by doing that. You don't understand the historical Constitution.
Another thing you point out is that many people have the myth that the Federalist Papers really are the key to understanding the Constitution. And as you point out, the Federalist Papers were basically an attempt to get the Constitution ratified.
Yeah, they were political documents, absolutely. And it's as if like 200 years hence, they're interpreting some law from today. And then they say, okay, we're going to look at the Republican Party platform, and that's the meaning of this law. Or they're going to look at the Democratic Party platform, and that's the meaning of this law. I mean, these were partisan debates, and they were trying to put the Constitution in the best possible light. So Hamilton, for instance, who was arguing very much for a strong government, kept arguing to some extent for a strong government, but then he had to back off because he knew his real argument wouldn't sell out of doors. So both Hamilton and Madison switched views on several issues, and then they switched back after the Federalist essays are written. By the way, a note on the Federalist Papers that I think listeners and hopefully readers of Constitutional Myths would be interested in is, why do we call them the Federalist Papers? That's, you know, listeners, anybody know that? See, I'm giving you a pause so you can think. There wasn't any such thing as the Federalist Papers. Those guys wrote under the name of Publius. This is Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, and they called their essays the Federalists. And not until 1961, well into the 20th century, did the name transfer over to the Federalist Papers because a commercial publisher decided that it would sell better. And today, we just assume that they wrote the Federalist Papers. Now, this doesn't have any interpretive meaning to it. I mean, it's not like originalism, which really does affect interpretation. But I tell this story to show how we assume today that we think we know what those guys were all about, and we just tweak things. We're reading history backwards. We just always look at it through our lens, and we don't go back to the original records. And that's, to me, I think we have to, if we're looking at history, we need to look at history and leave our views and our preconceptions by the door.
We're talking to Ray Raphael about the book Constitutional Myths. And another myth is that the framers of the American Constitution hated taxes. What's the real story there?
Okay, yeah. Okay, well, let's go back and look at it through their eyes, just as I was suggesting we do in all cases, okay? So here we are. We're in, we've just had the Regulators' Rebellion in Massachusetts. And the federal government the Federal Confederation is not really government, can't do anything about it. Why can't they? Well, they look in their coffers. Do we have enough money to maybe raise an army to put this thing down? And lo and behold, in the 6 months preceding the federal convention, the Constitutional Convention, this is the time where the rebellion in Massachusetts was underway, the states, who were the only source of income for Congress, had forked over a grand total of $663. That's it. That's what the feds had to work with. And with that, they had to defend from the Atlantic to the Mississippi and do anything else the government has to do with $663 in 6 months. So you could double that for a yearly total and adjust it for inflation or however you want to do it. But clearly, they needed something more, and what they needed was a source of their own revenue, and that's what the Constitution was all about. The very first power granted to Congress was the power to tax, any kind of tax. The only kind of tax they didn't allow was an export tax. So they thought, well, then, for instance, the North will try to pass an export tax on tobacco, and that wouldn't be fair. So everything else was totally fair game.
Now, the income tax didn't come for another, what, century or so?
Well, the income tax, there was nothing in the, they didn't think of mentioning an income tax because that would make no sense then. People didn't make incomes. Most people survived mostly through their own farm produce and what they could make, and then some trade and barter and some kind of like credit list at the local merchants. So income tax didn't make any sense, but they said all taxes can be broken down into two categories, direct and indirect. And they treated differently. And Congress has blanket powers to do any kind of indirect tax, like a duty or an excise or something. A direct tax is like on property or head tax. They had to apportion according to the population of each state, so they treated them differently. Now, income taxes did start coming in during the Civil War. As a matter of fact, the Civil War on the Union side was financed largely by an income tax, a progressive income tax, where the rich paid not only more but a greater share. And the Supreme Court said, had no problem with that. It's perfectly constitutional, they said. And so it wasn't until 1895 that a different Supreme Court said that there's two types of income taxes. There's taxes from wages and salaries, and those are perfectly legal. They're indirect. But taxes from interest, rent, and dividend are basically from property, for the income you make from property. So they're really a property tax, and therefore it has to be apportioned among the states. So they treated them differently, and you couldn't really apportion them by the states. That just had proved that it doesn't work. So basically, it was legal, but it was hard to do. So you had a situation in the Gilded Age where the Supreme Court says, sure, tax all the workers, but leave all the capitalists untouched. And that's the thing that created the 16th Amendment, which said income taxes are fine, which wasn't any big news because they always had been fine. It's just that there were two different types. And they said, but all taxes on all income from whatever source have to be treated equally and none have to be apportioned. So the whole 16th Amendment thing that people say created the income taxes, they're off base. Income taxes were perfectly legal, perfectly constitutional. It just simplified the tax code. So any anti-16th Amendment people out there, are you really against simplifying the tax code?
Right. Well, there have been vociferous opponents to taxes since the beginning of our history, and there are vociferous opponents to taxes now. Are their arguments similar or not?
Well, it's somewhat similar. I mean, nobody likes taxes. Washington, in his farewell address from the presidency, has this great passage. It says, you know, no tax has ever been invented that's not inconvenient and just, you know, unpleasurable and inconvenient. And the anti-tax people today like to quote that, saying, "Oh, Washington was opposed to all taxes," and then he goes on to say, but, you know, government can't survive without it. So, honestly, the thing to do is we just have to pay our taxes. But there's always been an anti-tax strain in American history. I mean, the whole thing from the beginning. And then after the Constitution, there was people proposed amendments to it. We can get into the Bill of Rights. Those were some of the amendments. But the most popular amendment that people out of doors were suggesting was to weaken the powers of taxation. That remember that the Constitution gave the Congress the broad powers of taxation, and they wanted to weaken it a little bit. They said, no, Congress can't pass direct taxes unless they've already asked the states and the states haven't come up with it. And people like Madison and Washington are just furious over this. They say, all the amendments that are suggested, we can go for any of them except that. You cannot weaken the power of taxation. And so there were those two strains right at the founding in the ratification debates about kind of the anti-tax strain and the pro-tax strain. But the truth is, guess who won? The pro-tax strain in the Constitution prevailed, that Congress has those powers. People continued to resist in particular cases, like the so-called Whiskey Rebellion in 1794, and then 4 years later there was another rebellion in Massachusetts about a property tax. But that, you know, and that's kind of endemic to the American experience. People can have legitimate objections to particular taxes, how much they pay, and so on, but don't cite the Constitution because you're on no ground whatsoever. The Constitution gives broad powers of taxation, period.
We're talking to Ray Raphael about his book, Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right. Let's talk for a moment about the Bill of Rights, which you mentioned a few minutes ago, and the myth that the Bill of Rights came from the Founding Fathers. Now, wait a minute. I thought that was true.
Well, once again, let's look at the historical record and look at it from their point. Did they gather in Philadelphia in 1787 to protect rights? Was that their issue at that time? No, it was to create a government. And they labored hard, and through those hot days, and they were shut up in that room, and they argued and they bickered, and they started in late May, and then it's June, July, August, September, and they're just about done. They kind of have their final draft here. And then George Mason says on September 12th, 5 days before they actually adjourn, hey, how about a Bill of Rights? Let's get a Bill of Rights in there. And everybody will look at each other and says, oh, come on, please don't bother me with that. And at that point, the rights that were protected by the Constitution are no ex post facto laws, no bills of attainder, and you have a right to a writ of habeas corpus and some trial by jury, but not all. And so that's it. And George Mason gets not a single state delegation goes with him. They just didn't want to do a Bill of Rights. They just said, hey, listen, the states have their bills and declarations of rights. That's good enough. And so then afterwards, outside, people are saying, wait a second, you know, you're going to create this strong government and there's no protections, you know. So there's a big clamor for a Bill of Rights. And then Washington and Madison, the pro-Constitution people mostly just fight it. But Washington and Madison say, wait a second, there's a lot of people out there. It's very disruptive. Let's give them something. So there were two types of amendments that people were proposing. One was the rights amendments, as we have in the Bill of Rights, and the other were these deep structural amendments that were really changing things. Most noticeably, they wanted to weaken the power of taxation. So Washington and Madison got together and they said, you know, we cannot weaken that power of taxation. Let's give the people the Bill of Rights because that won't really affect anything. And then they'll be happy and they won't complain so much. And then some of these strong anti-federalists at the time and say, oh, wow, these Bill of Rights, they're just milk and water. That's a direct quote. They're nothing more than a pinch of snuff because they wanted deeper changes. But anyway, so that was kind of the compromise. So Madison writes the Bill of Rights, and they get ratified. They came in through the back door and by the push of the people. So the framers were not all about rights. They were all about creating a government. And the rights came in after the fact from the people. They are part of our Constitution, and they very much should be part of our Constitution. But when people say, well, what does our Constitution do? Most people say, oh, yeah, well, it protects all our rights. And that wasn't the thrust of the thing. The thrust of the thing was to create a good government.
It's interesting also because what you're talking about really highlights the role of the people, as you call it in your book, out of doors, people who weren't inside the Constitutional Convention, in making sure the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were something that they could live with.
Yeah. It was kind of like a negotiated settlement. You know, it was like the Constitution would have gone into effect in any case, but there just would have been more clamoring out of doors if they hadn't gotten that Bill of Rights. And today it's kind of the process of co-optation. I mean, basically we refer to it, you know, when the center of authority co-opts a movement by ceding to some easy one of their demands, and then it kind of splinters the movement. Then there were a few hardliners who wanted to still resist, but most people said, no, okay, we got our rights. Well, let's just try the Constitution, and things settled down for a while. So, the people out of doors. And the other thing, when you look at how the Constitution was created, it's inside, it's very much indoors. They were in secret. They didn't want anybody to know what was happening. And they were very suspicious of the people, very suspicious, like Roger Sherman says, the people should have as little to do with government as possible. And that was kind of the mood inside the room, but they knew they had to sell the plan to the people out of doors. So they're always looking over their shoulder, will this fly? And they called it the genius of the people. Will the genius of the people go for this?
One of the myths that you talk about is this idea that the framers were guided by clear principles of limited government. In fact, there was a kind of ongoing battle between those who believed in strong and weak government. How did the Constitution, which, as we talked about, is a series of compromises, how did it finally end up?
Yeah, and people like James Madison wanted a very strong federal government, and we know Hamilton did. And Madison, who people think, oh, he's a straight states rights guy, he wanted during the convention, the federal government to have an absolute veto over all state legislation in all cases whatsoever. Whenever a state law went into effect, the Congress had the right to just nix it, even if it wasn't within its sphere. There was no such thing. It's like, so he was a strong advocate of national government. But there were they knew that the people out of doors really wanted to keep those state governments as entities. They're closer to home, and they think they can more represent the will of the people. So there's kind of negotiated settlements in there. They were trying to figure out, how do we create the strong federal government and yet still keep the states as kind of something? And they come up with this concept of dual sovereignty, and they come up with this question of they want to create a strong government, but they don't want it so strong that the people will reject it, they want a Republican government, and if a government is too strong, they're worried that, well, maybe it'll become a tyrannical government. So there's a balancing act. So whenever you say their purpose was to create limited government, you have to say, no, the purpose was to create a strong government, but not so strong as to oppress the people. In other words, like a strong government, but with defined powers. That was one of their, that's the balancing act that they're doing.
And one of the things, as we talked about, that they never foresaw was this alliance between corporations and government, which essentially created its own power structure that has the ability to oppress the people more than they could have dreamed of.
Yeah, and that's the big problem, is that, you know, they were dealing with what would be issues of their times, and giant corporate power. They had they had witnessed it in the East India Company. Some of these amendments, by the way, the proposed amendments from outside wanted to limit monopolies. They didn't want any kind of a government to give any kind of a special treatment to anybody. But they didn't foresee this. So when you look at this document, which was created in the 18th century, and see, you know, how does it govern us today? And you ask, well, what would the founders, people do this, what would the founders have thought about airport pat-down searches? You know, it's like the founders are the last people to look for advice for something having to do with airplanes and terrorism, which both of which are so totally out of their experience. We just have to, we can listen to sort of their general ideas, but then we have to apply them. And with corporations, they just didn't foresee this. It came from out of nowhere in their world. They didn't see the rise of industrial capitalism, the great concentrations of wealth, and so they didn't deal with it. They didn't do anything specifically to limit that power. So if you, and this is kind of gets to the big political issue today, if you say government is limited, because that's they wanted to limit government, but corporations are unlimited because they didn't even see them as a threat, you have a great imbalance of power where government can do nothing to check corporations for the public good. So I think you have to look at the Constitution as an overriding, their overriding aim was to create a common good, to create a government which could actually institute the common good. And then you have to take that aim and apply it to modern circumstances. If a corporation is polluting your environment right around you, there's nothing in the Constitution itself that says specifically that they can't. But the notion of general welfare and the notion that private people should not be able to usurp power and control other people, either in or out of government, they would agree with that. And we have to say, yes, you can limit the pollution that a corporation has and the effect that they have on the rest of the world.
Did the Constitution specify how constitutional disputes are to be resolved?
That's the greatest lack. When you think of, you know, yeah, they did everything. They just had it all zoned out perfectly, and all we have to do is follow them to a T. They forgot the biggest thing, which is how anybody's going to interpret it. It's kind of the meta issue. It's the issue that encompasses every other issue. They did not say who interprets the Constitution. They did not say the Supreme Court did. They just didn't say anything about it. They didn't say how it would be interpreted. So in the 1790s, you have Congress interpreting the Constitution. You have the President of Washington interpreting it his way, Adams interpreting it his way. You have the Supreme Court interpreting it its way, not just in Marbury Madison in 1803, but in 1796. There was another case that people don't talk about, but they're doing it too. And then, meanwhile, the people think, wait, we're the ones who signed, ratified the Constitution. We interpreted it. It's called popular constitutionalism. So everybody's assuming the power, and it's just tradition that eventually lands it on the Supreme Court. And again, nobody is saying anything about the methodology for interpreting it, whether they should, what standards they should use. So basically, the Constitution leaves to us more than we wish to admit. It didn't solve all our problems. We can use it. It has been a stabilizing effect in American history, because when you have a change of regime and then you just change the Constitution, that can be very unstable. We haven't had that, largely because of our Constitution. So it exists, it has its purpose, but you got to see that it doesn't solve everything, and we are, to some extent, on our own in key issues, such as how to interpret the Constitution.
As I was reading your book, I was really thinking about the distinction between, okay, you talk about original intent, and there were certainly moral codes that were prevalent among the class of people who were framing the Constitution in the late 18th century. So you've got, on the one hand, moral codes. On the other hand, you have basically a structure, which is the Constitution, which is a way of having a society, a kind of political document. And I think one of the ways we go wrong is when we try to interpret it according to their moral codes, as opposed to a kind of basic outline of how we're structuring our society.
Boy, you nailed that one. You nailed that one. I hardly have to say a word now. Exactly. It's exactly the case. They were interested in creating a structure of government that would allow people of the future to govern themselves. Because if they had a good structure, people themselves could figure out how that applies. If you say no, they wanted us to keep their moral code, well, of course, that would include slavery. Now, no longer, because that was changed by an amendment. But it would also include such things as a woman's right to own property, because that's never been changed by any constitutional amendment, by the 14th Amendment or the Women's Suffrage Amendment. And so if we're living by their moral code, then a married woman does not have the right to property. And so if the government takes your land and it sends the woman the check, the estranged husband who's not yet divorced, can just say, no, that's mine, because she didn't get any money. And another moral code, okay, so cruel and unusual punishment. So if you take their moral code, a sheriff is perfectly within his constitutional rights that once a person has been convicted for shoplifting and thrown in the county jail, the sheriff can brand his hands and lash him, because those were within their moral code. Then those were common punishments. They were not cruel and unusual. I could go on and on. You don't judge the moral code. Their particular moral code at that moment in time has nothing to do with the structure of the Constitution, which is still the structure that we live by.
We're talking to Ray Raphael about the book Constitutional Myths. So taking all the things that we've talked about, how do you see the flaws and the questions and the kind of craziness going on the internet in the debates about the Constitution today, specifically relating to President Obama and the problems that we're having in our society today and the conflicts we're having today?
Well, historically, they have nothing to do with it at all. And the reason I started writing Constitutional Myths is to separate history from politics, because historically, the Constitution was a document in its own time, and it had a purpose, which was to start a government and get it on its path. But now people are using that as this kind of this wedge to develop their own political and ideological slant. There's a great irony in that, because the point of the Constitution in the minds of the framers, the overarching point, was to serve as a unifying force. These states are bickering with each other, and then within each state there's class conflict, social unrest, and we want to get something more common that will really bring us together, right? And now people are waving their Constitution and using it as a tool to try to drive people farther apart, saying, because this Constitution says exactly what I want it to say. And it's a travesty. I think it's disrespectful to the people of those times and what they were trying to do. And what it does is it's just elevating. Whoever starts yelling at the Constitution about the Constitution and say, see, blah, 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 and then without the full absolute historical context, because people just take quotes out from anything any founder said at any time, they just take it out of context and say, see, this proves it. It's a violation of their integrity. It's not treating them as in their entirety, and it's basically saying my needs are more important than your needs, are more important than whatever general concept you have about the nation.
It's interesting because this is a young country, we're a couple of centuries old, but our Constitution is pretty long-lived compared to a lot of European countries who are much older than we are as societies and as cultures. What do you think are the relevant constitutional questions of our time?
Well, first of all, I want to address the thing. Yes, it's long-lived. And the reason it's long-lived is because it has been able to bend without breaking. If it stayed as rigid as people want to interpret it now, it would have broken long ago. The women would have demanded that they end the Constitution and risen up with arms in their militia units or something because they wanted the right of property, right? but it's because people, through most the dominant strain in American history, although arguing about the Constitution, have been able to allow it to adjust to the times, most famously, really, with the overturning of the Plessy in 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson. Now, we're talking about the 14th Amendment here, which is the Reconstruction, but that's part of the Constitution. They said separate but equal is okay. And in 1954, they say, you know, we've tried separate but equal for over half a century, and the fact is there's no such thing, and so it's not okay. So, you know, that's a classic example of the times kind of have a pull, a tug on the Constitution. And the true originalists say, no, you should never do that. And I'm saying, listen, if you can have the reality of the times not have any tug on the Constitution, you are literally living in the 18th century. And that's just not true. I like to think of the Constitution as an anchor in the bottom of the ocean, okay? And but what happens if it just stays there forever? The shoreline can change, all this stuff, and it gets irrelevant. What happens is the times exert this kind of slow tug on that anchor and kind of drag it along the bottom of the floor, moving it to slightly different locations. Now, separate but equal is not okay. Look at the issues of our times. Look at the change in attitudes towards same-sex marriage. I mean, just a decade ago, vastly unpopular, and now its majority favors it. And this is that's a fun one to watch because we can see the polls changing by the day. And the Constitution, we all know it's going to change, whether it changes exactly when it changes, but it's going to change. And it's just a question of how long that tug takes to budge it along a little bit. But the genius of the American Constitution and the American culture is that they have allowed it to move, although slowly and usually begrudgingly, in the direction of the times.
Ray Raphael is author of the book Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's been a delightful conversation.